Hello, welcome to the first ever episode of the ETB podcast. My name's Ewan Bennett, and this is my podcast. For some reason, I feel like I'm important enough to have my own podcast, so this is it. I want this podcast to be aimed at people that would like a career in music production and audio engineering. So basically, I'm just going to talk to as many producers as I can around my local area and see how they got started out. See if they can give any advice to people that would like a career in that field, and just have a good old chat with them about all sorts of things to do with music production and just life and music in general. So anyway, first ever episode is Dan Lucas. He very kindly invited me to his studio, and we had a long old chat about all sorts of things. So I hope you enjoy, and thank you for listening. Scripted or anything.
So you mentioned something about samples earlier.
Yeah.
What was that?
So obviously samples are used very heavily in modern day music. And for someone that seems like they have a lovely studio with lots of analog gear, are you someone that tends to use samples, or do you prefer to get a natural live drum sound if you can?
I think it's important on any occasion to try and get the drum sound as good as you can in the room, but the thing is there's only so much you can do in the room. Like, some things, the particular drum sound that you're after could be physically impossible to achieve in the room. So it's one thing if it's like a jazz drummer and you're miking the kit with two mics and, it's all very natural sounding. But if it's like a high energy sort of radio rock band or something like that, or even a metal band, there's only so far you can go. And you might have the best drum room ever, the best mic technique ever, the perfect mics for the job, great drummer, great kit, all those ingredients. Mm. And, you've got everything to the most tiny detail as near as you possibly can.
That's all you can do, really.
You might still want to take that drum sound further. Yeah. You might not even necessarily use samples to achieve that. Like, it could be really extreme compression and, parallel distortion. And, there's all sorts of stuff you can do. But certainly, I'm definitely not a fan of 100% replacement. Yeah. I would only do that in a really extreme scenario, or if I'd been sent something to mix that was recorded elsewhere and there was no hope for it. I don't like to hear that samples have been used. Mm. I still like the drums to sound organic, but if layering a snare sample underneath, or a kick sample or a tom sample, is going to make those drums sound better, then 100% I'm going to do it.
Because at the end of the day, that's what people are hiring you for, and to make their stuff sound good.
They want their drums to sound as good as possible. And again, with stuff like I use Slate Trigger too, and you can have velocity sensitive samples. So, again, you don't want a kind of snare roll to have everything of the same velocity, and it sounds like a robot playing it. So I still like it to sound natural. But the thing is, I read an interview or watched an interview with Andrew Sheps, and he sort of said it best. And he's basically saying that the people that listen to these records, most of them aren't even going to know what a sample is. All they care about is that it feels right when they listen to it. And even those that know what a sample is, does it even matter? Like, if it sounds good, it is good. So it doesn't really matter what you've used to get there. It doesn't matter if you've recorded something on a Behringer Euro desk. Like, at the end of the day, if it sounds good, it is good, whether that's with samples or without. It's genre specific as well.
Definitely. I think metal definitely lends itself more to using kind of sample, modern day metal. You can definitely tell that the kick drum is a sample.
And there's like certainly at the very least, most sort of metal stuff, there's samples layered under that. And the thing is, I've never kind of, you know, people go, oh, what, like using a sample's cheating and stuff, but it's not really, because you're not just opening up a sample and going, great, cool, right, yeah, the kick drum's
sorted.
You've got to
blend it nicely.
It's the way you make it work with the mics. It's the phase relationship between the sample and the mics, mm-hmm. the way you EQ it. Like, you still have to manipulate it quite a lot.
Yeah.
And again, I guess the same can be said for when people say, I don't like samples because it's not the natural drum sound. Mm. Like, if you take a snare and you gate it, compress it, EQ it, add a bit of distortion to it,
that's not the natural drum sound.
That's not what it sounded like anyway. No. So what's the, you know, there's no sort of difference really.
So rather than doing all that on a snare that you recorded yourself, you can just, you know, get a snare that someone else has recorded and layer it over the top.
Yeah, I mean, I will tend to, I process stuff really, really heavily. Mm. And like I say, even if whenever I'm recording a band, I'll take my time and I'll get the recording as good as I possibly can.
Yeah.
You know, everybody knows that goes without saying. There's no way that you should think, oh, well, I can just sort this out later with a sample. Like, you know, I think things like samples or even grid editors and stuff can make musicians or producers lazy because they think, oh, I'll, that will do, I'll sort it. I don't think that's a good approach at all. But, you know, as I say, like, I will process stuff really heavily. In fact, it reminds me of, I bought an album years ago by a band called Kill It Kid. The album's called Feet Fall Heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to this album and I thought, right, straight away, it's been recorded at some, you know, like Toe Rag Studios or somewhere that's just swimming in lovely, like, old vintage analog gear. It's just got this whole organic, lovely, like, vintage analog-y sort of vibe. I thought the band were probably American. It had this real authentic, bluesy, Americana-y sort of sound. Anyway, I was reading the sort of liner notes and I saw that the guy that recorded it and mixed it, he's a guy I know of just through the sort of audio world, and he lives in Wales. And I thought, oh, maybe, you know, maybe if he's based there, maybe it wasn't done in America. And then I started to research this band and then I found out they were from Bath. And then I managed to get in touch with the guy who engineered it and mixed it, who he's now become a really good friend of mine, like a guy called Charlie Francis. And we became Facebook friends and we started chatting about recording and stuff. And I said to him, you know, like, how did you record it? And, you know, I was expecting him to come back and say, you know, they used all these like vintage tube mics and all this stuff that I would never be able to afford. And it was basically recorded in a studio that is closed down now. It was called Fortress Studios. And I'd been there years before with a friend's band. And it's sort of above a pub in Shoreditch. And I remember him saying that it, like, all the gear in there was knackered, like nothing worked properly. I think he said some days, like, the desk didn't even work properly. I can't remember the exact details, but it wasn't a great environment at all. And then he told me that he mixed the whole thing in Pro Tools in his attic in Cardiff. He's got a sort of mixing room in his attic. And everything was done with plugins and it was all a completely digital mix. And I said to him, it literally sounds like the most organic analog vintage sounding mix I've ever heard. And he was just like, oh, it's just the way I've processed it. And then he started to tell me about some of the stuff he had done when he was mixing this record, and he would be like, right, well, with the vocals I've parallel compressed them, then I've got a Devil Lock, like a Sound Toys plug-in on them, then I've compressed them again, then I've sent them to this, then I've got them sent to a stereo delay, then I've processed them through. And it was insane, like, the amount of stuff he'd done. And I thought, oh, you know, I'd always thought at that point, to have a really natural, organic sounding recording, you'd have to be quite sort of sparing with processing and leave it alone. But he's actually processed the living daylights out of it just to end up with this beautiful, natural, organic sounding recording. But, you know, he said, well, if I had just left it alone, it just wouldn't have sounded like that.
Yeah.
And so then I thought, I'm going to be less afraid of processing stuff.
Yeah.
Like, at the end of the day, I don't care if my snare on whatever record I'm doing sounds like it did in the room when I recorded it. All I care about is that by the time the consumer hears it,
it sounds
they're
good.
Like, wow, what a great snare sound. So I don't think there should be any sort of rules about, you know, how much processing you do.
No,
look
definitely.
At Chris Lordow. Like, I don't know if you've seen any of his videos YouTube of him
sitting in front of one of their massive consoles sliding around on his chair.
He's got his SSL, but he's like, his personality comes across as quite bold and adventurous aggressive.
He's not afraid to do
and
stuff.
His mixing style is the same, but there's a video of him on YouTube and he's EQing a snare and he's literally just cranking the top end and then he calls up the bottom snare mic and he's like, oh, most people will high pass it and get rid of all the low end, but he's like, no, there's loads of good stuff in there, and he's cranking that up as well. And you know, he's one of the most successful mixers of all time.
He mixed the album Psycho by Muse, and when I heard that album I was like, damn, that's it sounds really fucking good.
Oh, he's great. Yeah, and he's, you know, he's done like American Idiot and you know, some of the biggest records out there. And his brother Tom Lordow, again, you know, pretty much Blink-182's entire back catalogue, Limp Bizkit, like all sorts. I think Tom Lordow is a bit less irritating as a person. Chris Lordow is just a little bit,
he's very
And he's got a bit of a sort of celebrity mixer sort of vibe, whereas Tom Lordow is a little bit more sort of reserved, but they've both got a similar style. Like, they're both super aggressive with compression.
Well, that's the thing, that's how you kind of get your own style, is just by doing these things that are not, that, you know, other people wouldn't really think of doing.
Yeah,
and that's how you kind of evolve your mixing style and production style.
Well, that's the thing, it's about being, you know, not afraid of sort of throwing the rule book out, because the consumer doesn't fucking care about the rules.
No.
Like, you know, another example would be somebody like Owen Morris, who, when Oasis recorded Definitely Maybe, I think they'd been through all sorts of mixers, and I think they'd recorded the album like two or three times and it wasn't working. And eventually Alan McGee at Creation Records was like, I know a guy and I'm going to give it to him and he's going to mix it and you're going to leave him alone and he's going to sort it all out. And they're like, no, we want to know what he's doing and stuff. Anyway, Owen Morris is this like crazy Welsh guy that I think has just done a lot of cocaine and had a lot of late nights, and he's just a bit of a sort of law unto himself from like interviews I've seen. And there's a really good interview where he's talking about he was in the studio and he called up all these guitar tracks and like he phoned Noel Gallagher up and he was like, look, on this song there's like 12 takes of this same lead part, which is the actual take you want me to use? And Noel was like, I want all 12 of them playing together. And he's like, no, I'm not having that. And Noel was like, no, I've recorded all 12. I want this like multi-layer thing. So in the end, Owen Morris is just like, oh, piss off. Yeah. I'm going to do what I want. Deleted them all except for one. And he said, like, most of the time he was like, off of his nut on something when he was mixing this record, and he had everything in the red, and he'd at the start of the song Cigarettes and Alcohol, literally like two bars in, or not even that, you hear this all this like hiss and noise come on the guitar, and I'd always thought Noel had intentionally like trodden on a distortion pedal or something, but it turns out that Owen Morris was like so drunk or whatever when he was printing the mix, he accidentally knocked a compressor on and it just went, and then he was just like, oh, I kind of like that.
That's so crazy.
But when he delivered them the mixes, they went crazy for them, and he just managed to capture all that swagger and attitude and aggression of that band by literally throwing the rule book out. He just did what he wanted with it, and he had everything in the red and just left shitty noises on there and stuff. But it helped catapult them, you know, into the stratosphere. And that's very much his thing. Like, he then, after that, they said, well, when we do What's the Story, Morning Glory, the next record, we want you to produce it as well. And then I think he did Be Here Now as well. He did 1977 by Ash. They've all got that sort of sound. Like, and, you know, I think sometimes you're, certainly in the education system, you're told really that a proper recording is one that sonically sounds really good, and the snare's got to be nice and clean, and the kick drum's got to be nice and punchy. Like most Oasis records, you can barely even hear the drums. They're all thin and trashy and distorted, but it works perfectly
with the rest of it,
for that band. So, you know, when I was a teenager and I listened to that record, I didn't care, or even if I listened to like And Justice for All by Metallica, I didn't care that you can't hear the bass on it. Like, I just listened to it and I thought, this is great. It's like really aggressive and it made me feel good to listen to. So I think that's the most important thing, is not losing sight of how the mix feels and doing whatever is necessary so that you can sit back and go, I've done these songs justice. The snare's nice and clean. You can hear the toms are clearly panned there. And, you know, that's because someone's then going to put that on. How weird is that? That is the owner of Rimshot Studios.
The one that we were just talking about.
Yeah. My band, Salvation Jane, are doing some sessions with Sylvia Massey in June, and we were going to do them at Red Bull in London, like Red Bull Studios.
Nice.
And because, like, I don't know if are you familiar with Sylvia Massey?
No, I'm not.
She's basically like the most successful female producer ever. She like engineered the first System of a Down record. She's done Prince, Johnny Cash, Slayer, Slipknot, literally everybody. And she was Rick Rubin's engineer, so anything that Rick Rubin produced between 94 and about 2001, Sylvia Massey would be the engineer. And she was the in-house engineer at Sound City. I don't know if you've seen that documentary. But a lot of the footage is her gear. Her Neve console was at Sound City. But she's well known. In fact, this is a perfect example of what we were just talking about. She's well known for her weird recording techniques and completely breaking the mould. And she, like, pioneered this. Here, I'll show you this thing.
Oh, I know exactly, yeah.
So, SM57
in the hose pipe.
The hose, and then the other end taped up, and you sort of drape it around the drum kit, and you get this huge room sound, especially when you compress it really hard, without any cymbals. And she does all sort of, like, I don't know how she does it, but she... If you just type in Sylvia Massey on YouTube, there's videos of her where she's made a cable and she's like rooted the guitar into like a wedge of cheese and come out of it into Pro Tools, and it adds this weird like fuzzy sound to the guitar. I have no idea how it works. But she's recorded a guitar through a pickle. She'll record a guitar through some sort of household appliance, like a blender or something, and or a light bulb is one of her things. And she's talking about how different bulbs have different sound qualities. And there's like a video of her in the studio of a guitarist, and as soon as he starts playing, the bulb lights up. but it does something to the sound.
It's crazy.
But she's an amazing mixer, like amazing engineer, and a really cool, quirky, kind of slightly crazy.
So how did you get in contact with her then?
Oh, right. So, yeah, sorry, I've diverted.
That's right.
So basically, my band, Salvation Jane, were like, oh, we need to do some stuff for like online content, like some live studio session videos. And we're like, well, we could do it here like we usually do. But I was speaking to a friend of mine called Katie Tavini, who's a mastering engineer. And being a sort of female in the audio world, you know, one of the people she looks up to is Sylvia Massey.
Mm.
And anyway, we were chatting about, I can't remember how we were talking about it, but she was like, oh, imagine if you could get Sylvia Massey to like produce the band or something. And I was like, maybe I could. And then she was saying that Red Bull London, they allow people to use their studios for free, providing it's a project that they think is worthwhile.
That's cool.
And you know, that's an incredible studio. And I was like, well, you know, we could do like a live session, 3 or 4 songs, get Sylvia Massey to produce it and record it in using some of her weird techniques. And then you know, then I would mix it and Katie Tavini would master it, and because there's 3 girls in the band as well, we'd do like a sort of women in music kind of thing. So I emailed Sylvia's manager and he was like, yeah, this is what she charges, which is like a lot of money. But he said she's going to be in London over the summer. I spoke to Red Bull Studios and they were really up for it. However, because she's so in demand, it's been difficult to pin down dates, and it's taken months of emailing back and forth. She's doing some stuff at Abbey Road, and the band she was going to be working with was struggling to get the money together because Abbey Road is just like
ridiculous,
silly money.
Yeah.
And anyway, he's come back to us the other day and said, you can have the 12th of June. And that's literally the only time she can do it. Mm. We were going to do a long day on the 12th of June, but Red Bull is booked then. So I thought, right, we'll just do it here then.
Mm.
But then I was like, I want, you know, I mean, there's certainly enough space here, but we want to make it a bit different to what we've done before and a bit special.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, actually, Mike's a good friend of mine, and Rimshot looks amazing.
Yeah, it does.
Like,
yeah.
The gear is amazing.
It's insane.
And there's tons and tons of space there. And it's sort of good exposure for everybody, because he would engineer it.
Right.
She would be producing it and sort of working with him. I would get to mix it. Katie will get to master it. The band will be in it. You know, like Michael also get his studio will be in the videos and stuff as well. Obviously, like we're going to hire we're going to pay him to hire it as well. But it will sort of be beneficial for everybody in the equation. So I've just emailed her manager back to say, look, this is where we're going to do it. And then hopefully it's just a case of putting it in the diary.
That's really cool.
But yeah, I was going to say, she bought this book out, and it's made up of loads of interviews with well-known engineers and producers, and all their more unusual techniques that they use. And then there's some of hers, look, like there. She's got a little mic on a radio control car.
She's moving it around.
Yeah. And,
so crazy.
But she's got a chapter in here called How to Mic a Chicken. And she does all these funny illustrations. She's a really good artist as well. But she'll do stuff like, you know, like there's just cool stuff like different snare miking positions. But it's for people that want to think outside the box.
Mm.
This is her. She's got a weird thing she makes for if she's got cymbals that sound too bright. She's got a weird paste that she makes to dirty up the cymbals.
That's really cool.
Yeah, you should watch. If you just type her name into YouTube, she puts all these really short videos up that are like sort of 2 minutes long. And it will be like, oh, this is how she has a thing on drums that she calls the dick mic, where she'll have, you know, if the drummer is sort of playing like this, she's got a mic sort of over the kick drum, sort of pointing at his dick, basically. And when she solos it, it sounds brilliant, and you just get a really nice balance of the whole kit, and you don't really get too many cymbals because they're sort of above and behind the mic. And then when you compress that and put it in with the rest of the drums, it ties the whole kit together. And it's a really nice way. Like, I find if you just close mic a kit, so, you know, supposing you just had a single kick mic, a top snare, two tom mics and two overheads, like six mics, you can get a really nice drum sound like that, but it all sounds a bit too separated.
Yeah, definitely.
Until you bring the room mics in. But with this dick mic, that just glues it all together, and you get a bit of that ambience, and you'd actually don't even need any room mics if you don't want to.
Oh, that's cool.
But yeah, you'd probably really like her videos.
I'll check them out.
But I also got a really good tip from her with reamping the snare. So, you know, another thing that you could do is, supposing you record a drummer in your live room, you can then send the snare recording back out through a guitar amp.
I've tried that, actually.
Lay it on the floor face up and put the actual snare drum itself face down, with the snare wire sort of facing upwards, and then mic, and then obviously when you hit play, every time the snare sound comes out of the amp, it triggers off that snare drum.
Yeah.
Mic that up with a stereo pair of room mics, and then put it under the track, and all of a sudden you get this, and then you can compress it really hard or add reverb to it. Again, that's something I tend to do. Mostly if I've been sent something that has been recorded elsewhere and they've not sent any room mics, or the room mics don't sound very nice, that's definitely worth doing.
Yeah.
But again, you know, these are people like her and Owen Morris and Chris Lord-Alsh. All the successful mixers and producers are people that think outside of the box and that aren't afraid to be creative and
don't
break
stick to the rules.
That's a long way of saying yes, I use samples.
That's the thing I love about podcasts, they go completely off on tangents,
but yeah, you know, going back to that, yes, like if it's going to improve it, then just do it. Like, don't be a purist. A guy I know, like a while ago, he was recording a band, and one of them was like, oh, could we do this to it in the mix or something, and he was just like, no, like, we're going to get it right on the way in, and then it stays like that. That's how you've do it properly, or something like that. Like, if it's got, you get the sound that you, the sound that you've envisioned for the final product, that's what you should record in. And I was like, what a load of fucking nonsense, because you, like I said initially, that's not always physically possible.
No, I mean, get it
and
as good
as
you
just
can.
Like, you know, and then you've got less work to do during the mix, and I'm like, I want to work when I'm mixing. Like, I don't want to just sit there and throw the faders up and go, oh, it's done.
Yeah,
I'll just add a bit of reverb.
Yeah,
like, so I like getting really stuck into it and turning it into something else, not just going, oh, well, you can hear everything clearly, you know, it's all panned and balanced quite nicely, and the EQ's doing what it should be doing, it's done. It's all the stuff. I mean, I you know, I could show you some stuff later where I've mixed things and there's all sorts of shit going on underneath that you'd never even know was there if you just listened
to
the track. But it all adds to the energy, and, you know, like,
yeah, going back to what we were saying earlier about that guy that mixed the Oasis tracks, was just in his loft, you know, and it was recorded in a studio, didn't have like analog gear and stuff like that. Do you think gear is important for a recording studio? I mean, obviously from an outsider's point of view, it would be more, you'd probably want to go to a studio that has more, you know, nice equipment as such. But from an engineer's point of view, do you think that can make or break the recording process?
No, not really. I think unless it's knackered gear or something like that, I think, you know, the studio is only as good as the engineer that's in it. So you could put somebody in somewhere like Abbey Road, for example, with their lovely Neves or whatever it is they've got in there. Their what's their own brand? Their FG, whatever it is, consoles that they make. And they could do the most shocking recording ever. And then you could give someone a few mics and a little notepad mixer and stuff, but if they know what they're doing, they'll get great results. It's nice to have nice gear and to have a choice of gear. So, you know, I would, if I were recording rock bands, I think, or certainly rock drums, I would prefer to use like API preamps because they're a lot more punchy. Or, you know, like, it's nice to have options, but a great recording can should really be able to be done on most things. Unless you're limited to like track count or something like that, or if you've got a tiny little mixer and you can only put three mics on a kit, that could be detrimental to the recording. But I think it's more important that people develop their skills first and foremost, and then as time goes on, you can add more colours into the palette and then go, oh, well, actually, I think now I'll patch that snare into that preamp because I'll get more punch out of it, and I'll get a fatter sound if I use the Neve style preamp. So I think I might put my bass guitar through that, or, you know, like,
I know that I certainly, when I was first starting out, that I always wanted to have loads of really nice gear, and that was really important to get people to come into my studio, which obviously isn't, because now I've, you know, a couple of years down the line, I know that now, because I've, you know, progressed in my, in how I do things, and I think that I've got to a level that I'm, you know, pretty happy with at the moment. Obviously, I'm always learning stuff, and, you know, I don't think you can ever not learn more stuff when you're recording.
Yeah, but, until the day you die, you're always learning stuff. I know stuff now that I didn't know 2 weeks ago. And if you're working with musicians all the time, you're learning stuff constantly from them, and you know, you should never be one of these engineers that has, you know, that shares those stupid memes that are like, I'm the engineer, that's therefore I know everything, and you know nothing, and all that kind of stuff, because, you know, you, like, I've got a guy that I've recorded a few times called Rick, who he's crazy about vintage drums, and he's got some insane collection of vintage drum kits, and when he comes in, he'll bring like two or three kits with him, and he'll be talking about, oh, this is a Camco, and these were made between this period, and like, these sound better for this kind of thing. Like, he's really passionate about vintage drums. So by the time he goes home, I know all this stuff about vintage drums that I didn't know before.
And like, from a like your point of view, it's probably better to let him make the choice on which kit to use, that
of course,
because he's the one that knows a lot about it, and you might, you know, suggest something that would make the recording at the end of the day sound
more about vintage drums than I do. So I want to absorb that information, and then down the line, if a band's like, oh, we really want to go for like a really cool vintage drum sound on this recording, this is the sort of thing we want,
you can,
I can be like, oh, actually, I reckon if I get a Camco in, that'll be the right, because I've learned stuff from Rick. But yeah, I mean, like, it's everyone's dream to have a nice studio and loads of gear to choose from. And certainly, I think when you get to a level where you're trying to attract higher profile clients,
that does help.
They just expect to see things in the studio, and in actual fact, you might never even use half of it. You might have racks and racks of, like, you know, 1073 preamps or U87, whatever. and you know damn well that you're not even going to use those, maybe, but they just like to know it's there. Yeah. And it's sort of shallow, really, but it's just become a thing. But no, it's not important, really. Like, what's important is your skills and you learning to use the gear that you've got.
Yeah.
And then, like I say, it's good to have choices. So I've got all these guitar amps here because I don't want a band to come in and go, oh, we really want this guitar sound. Or for me to go, oh, this guitar sound would be great. And then I'm like, oh, well, we're literally limited to the amps that they've brought with them or the couple of amps that I've got. So,
see, that's a problem that I have at the moment because, you know, I'm still kind of working my way up, and I only have limited amount of, I'd say I put more money into like studio gear, like interfaces and outboard gear and stuff like that, as opposed to things that the bands can use.
Yeah.
Because most of the time that I've recorded bands, they have bought decent gear with them. And I do have, you know, friends that will lend me nice amps if I really need them and stuff like that. So,
well, the thing is, it's making the most out of what you've got to work with, and it's good practice. Like, if a band comes in and they're like, well, we want this kind of guitar sound, and then you've only got one amp there to do it with, then you've got to work with that the best way you can and maybe try it with a pedal and stuff. If you just started out and you were blessed with a nice big studio with tons and tons of stuff, you would just, if you were ever not in that situation, you'd be screwed. So, you know, I know now that because of where I've come from, and again, I started out with like a little setup in my parents in my bedroom at my parents' house, but if I went to a studio, say in Leeds or somewhere like that, and it was a tiny studio and there wasn't a lot of gear in there, I know that I would make the most out of what is there, and I would be able to get good results out of hopefully out of whatever is there, because I've had that
experience before.
So, like I say, that's the most important thing. It's learning to use what you've got, you know. Experimenting, it helps if your studio is where you live. Then you can go down there, you can watch stuff on YouTube, and you can try stuff out for yourself.
That's definitely, I spend hours and hours in my studio just trying. Half the time the things don't work out, but then I'll know that they don't work out and I can learn from that. Like, just different mic positions in the live room. You know, I can't think of the amount of times that I've tried different positions with the room mics and just move them all around the room and just found the best place for them. Mainly miking techniques. I think that's such an important thing to learn early on. It's all good throwing a microphone in front of something, but if you do it in the right way, it can just magnify that and make it 10 times better than it would be if you just chuck something in front of it.
No, totally.
It's definitely something that people should learn early days, you know. My old band recorded at a studio. I won't mention which one it was. And the studio is lovely. It's a really nice studio, you know, loads of really nice gear. And the guitarist in my band was like, yeah, let's go there, they got really nice gear. And I was like, okay, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure who we'll be working with. So anyway, turned up, worked with this guy, and I said that I'd like to mix it, so we basically just recorded all the stems there and I took it home. And honestly, we probably would have been better off going somewhere half the price with maybe not as nice equipment, but someone that really knows what they're doing. And unfortunately, that wasn't the case, and I ended up with a bunch of okay stems that I really had to work with to make sound good. But it's just the fact that we were in this beautiful studio and we got not a lot out of it.
Yeah.
Because,
well, that's the thing, it's just down to the person.
Yeah.
And but, you know, going back to sort of mic techniques and stuff, you could, some stuff that people swear by might not work for you or might not work in your room. Like, I've tried stuff that sounds like, I always do this with a snare, or, you know, like a side snare mic or something. And every time I try it, it just sounds like absolute shit. And I just can't get it to work. I've tried different mics. I just hate the sound of it. But then I've got stuff that I do that I've recommended to other people, and they're like, I just can't work with that. I can't get it to,
it's completely,
you know, it's just experimenting.
It's subjective as well, isn't it? You know, it's what one person might absolutely swear by, another person will hate the sound of. It's all about finding your own like we said, with the mixing, finding your own style for recording as well, because they're both very important things in themselves.
And that's the thing, and there's no sort of really right or wrong. You know, there's only wrong if you've got like phase issues or if drums are tuned
like
badly
and physics and stuff like that, isn't it? Like
there's that sort of stuff, but you know, in terms of what a good sound is, like I say, I mean, I think there is a threshold where you could just listen to something and be like, anyone would not like the sound of that. But yeah, in terms of, there's been so many different weird techniques over the years that have been used on records that have sold millions of copies. Like I say, it's just finding stuff that works. You know, I've got stuff now that I go through phases of, I'll discover like a miking process that's brilliant, so I'll tend to do it on everything that's in that sort of style. But then 6 months later,
you'll be doing something different.
I'll be doing something different, or I'll have seen something else or spoken to someone else and I'll have discovered something else I'm trying, or I'll get another mic that completely changes the game. So it's a constantly evolving thing. And then of course you then, you're like, oh, I wish I'd known this when I recorded such and such. But yeah, I guess that's the same for everybody.
Yeah.
You always want to go back and redone stuff.
The amount of times that I've listened to, you know, stuff that I've done in the past and just really wish that I could change it, but it's already been released and blah, blah.
Yeah. If you're working on something that's being done over quite a long period of time, you know, if it's something that someone just keeps coming back to, sometimes you end up opening a project up and then you're like, what the hell was I thinking there? Why is that plugin doing that? But there would have been a reason for it at the time. And then now you're just like, what was I thinking?
Yeah.
Oh, there's a much better way of doing that. Yeah. Or I don't even know what that's adding.
You know, I can even do that the next day. So like, I'll work on a mix in the evening, go to bed, come back the next day and be like,
yeah,
oh, I hate this. Yeah. Like, it's so mood dependent, I think.
Definitely.
That's all part of it.
But every person in the industry is like that.
I don't think anyone's really ever happy, like 100% with what they do.
Well, I know that like David Bendeth was saying that he, you know, and he's mixed, like he mixed Riot by Paramore. Like, he's done a lot of bands like
that
Four
Paramore
Years
snare
Strong.
The famous Paramore snare,
yeah, that's the album.
Yeah.
But the guy, Dan, whatever his name is, who sort of partially engineered it, I've seen him sort of taking credit for that in interviews, but it's 100% David Bendeth. But yeah, that's a great... Well, the whole record sounds great, but he did that. He's done stuff like 4 Years Strong and Breaking Benjamin and a lot of those kind of bands, but he also mixed... That Elvis album is called 30 Number Ones, and it's got a gold cover, and you always see it in like service stations and stuff. But he did that. Like, he's done some massive records, and he's arguably like one of the best producers and mixers out there. He's about 65 now, 66, something like that, and he was saying in an interview that he hated every mix he'd done before he was 45 or something. And it was only when he got to about 45 he thought, actually, you know, I'm all right at this.
Yeah.
But he was also saying that even now, every time he sends a mix off to the client, he's like, oh, they're going to hate it. I'm going to get fired. And his mixes are just insane. But, you know, even people of his level feel that way.
Yeah.
Crippling self-doubt just sort of comes with the
territory. Yeah. Definitely.
And you know, I'm the same with my stuff. Like, I'll send something to a band and sometimes they'll take days to reply, and you're like, I sent that to them 3 or 4 days ago, and I'm like, oh my god, they hate it, and they're trying to work out how to tell me that they're not happy with it at all.
It's like a breakup.
And then you'll get the response you get is actually like the complete opposite.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, we've just been listening to it on different systems or something. And you're like, oh, thank god.
But I don't think I've ever had a mix that I've sent it off and they've been like, cool, like that's perfect, because I don't think that's, unless you are insanely good at what you do, I don't think you could ever get exactly what someone wants, because you're not them and you can't envision it in the same way. But I really like it when people tell me that they want stuff changed, because I'm like, yeah, cool, let's let's do it, because it's clearly not as good as it could be. One day you might think it's really good, and then the next day you've changed your mind again. So
I guess, again, there's, you know, some people don't know what it is they want. Like some people are just like, we don't know how we want it to sound, we just want the song sort of produced properly. Yeah. So sometimes those people will, you know, not want any adjustments. But yeah, sometimes people will say, oh, could we have this more like this? And then you're like, oh, actually, I really like that. Yeah. It's an improvement. Yeah. Sometimes people will suggest stuff and you're just like, this is literally going to make it sound
really
bad. It's
such a horrible situation to get in, isn't it? When you know that their suggestions just aren't going to work.
Mm.
And it's almost like you have to take the reins for a bit and just be like, no, we're not doing that. And that's such a horrible thing to do, because they're the ones that are paying you. You feel like you should be doing exactly what they want you to do.
I mean, the thing is, you've got to, like, I think, you know, you have got a reputation to think about as well. So it's a case of being tactful with the way you approach that sort of subject. Like, you know, and again, this is like I say, often when people are learning about being a producer or whatever, they just... All the focus seems to be on the technical side of it and gear and stuff, but there's actually, you know, it's your people's skills, and it's being able to tell people basically your idea is going to ruin the whole mix without
in a nice way
and a way that, and making them open-minded, making them trust you, you know, putting them at ease, like all that kind of stuff. And you know, like I say, basically when they make a suggestion that you just think is going to destroy everything or make it sound amateurish, is being able to say to them no.
I mean, sometimes I'll do like another mix their way and then but still keep the original one and just be like, look, really, really think about it. Which one do you prefer? Yeah. And half the time they'll go back to the original.
Yeah.
Because it just hasn't worked.
Like, at least sort of saying, well, let's hear it then.
Mm.
You know, if everyone feels this way, let's hear it. And then we'll sort of go from there. And then you can just sort of pray that they're going to sort of see sense.
Mm.
Because again, you know, there's a line, like, yes, there is that, it's all subjective and there's no right and wrong. But then there is a sort of line that can sometimes cross where you're just like, oh, this really just doesn't sound good. And the only person that is going to think it sounds good is the guy that suggested it. So it's just sort of knowing when that line's been crossed. But like I say, it's a big part of the job is learning to deal with people.
Yeah.
And as I say, getting your ideas across to them and sort of making them feel like you're all working towards the same thing. You know, you all want what is best for these songs.
Yeah, I've definitely had a few experiences where people have really tried to control where the mix is going and want to be in on every single detail of what, like, I've had a few people that sat in with me whilst I'm mixing and they don't really necessarily know a whole lot about, you know, the mixing process, and then they want me to explain every single detail of what I'm doing to their track.
Oh god.
And it's horrible because it completely throws me off. Like, if I'm mixing, I'll just get lost in it for like 3 hours and just be completely involved
just
with
in
it
zone.
And it just completely just threw me off. And then I listen back to the mixes now and I'm like, god no, they could be so much better.
Well, I think the thing is you go on and you get more experience and a longer client list and all that kind of stuff, you, like, people tend to be, they'll be more willing to do as they're told.
Yeah.
And sort of like now most of my work comes because people have heard stuff I've done before, or they've spoken to a band I've worked with, or I've been recommended to them, or, you know, they'll know that, like, my stuff's been on Kerrang or whatever. So I've got a bit more authority than I would have had like a few years ago. Like, now they'll sort of think, oh, like, you know, they trust me more.
Yeah.
But certainly for the first few years that I was doing it, like, you know, I would have people pointing at plugins and do this and do that. And I had a guy a couple of years ago in that would just, you know, I'd call up my list of plugins and he'd be like, what's that one? And he'd just see the name of one that he liked the look of.
Yeah.
I'd be like, oh, this does this. So, oh, cool. Put that on everything. And I'm like, well, no, because if I do that, then this is going to happen, and you know, it's all going to end up a muddy mess.
See, that's
mess.
The thing. Like, a lot of people don't understand that if you change one thing in a mix, it can completely, it changes a lot of other things, and people don't necessarily realise that that is a thing.
You get the, oh, it's perfect. It's just the bass guitar's getting a little bit lost. Okay, cool. And we turn the bass up a little bit. Yeah, okay, done that. We just turn that guitar part up a little bit. Yeah. And then you're like,
you just end up
getting
the whole mix
up. We'll do that. Rhythm guitar's getting a bit lost. Let's just crank that up as well. Now the guitars are too loud on the voice. And then before you know it, the mix is exactly the same, just like 1.5 dBs louder.
Yeah, I've definitely had that before.
You know, you get that sort of thing. Or, you know, like I say, bands will go, well, we've literally got two changes. And then you'll do those two changes, send it over to them. And then they'll come back and go, oh, just a couple more things.
Yeah.
And then they'll send another four things through. And then you do that. But then that's had a knock-on effect on the two changes you did a couple of days before. And then you'll send it to them. Oh, just one more thing. Can we do this? And then it'll be a big thing that totally changes the sound of the mix.
Yeah.
And then, but you feel like saying to them, can you just listen to it for a few days? Just send me one list of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I'll do it and I'll send it to you, and that'll be fine. Like, rather than just
back and
forth
now
constantly. We want to change this as well, and then, but then, you know, you make those changes that they want, and then that, like we're saying, has a knock-on effect, so then they want other changes. And but, you know, everyone has to do that. I think though David Bendeth, he has some sort of approach where he'll basically mix the track during the day, obviously his assistant will like prep it and stuff, and then he will it'll get to like 6 o'clock, and then he'll send the mix over to the band, and then they've got 3 hours to listen to it all. He'll go off and have his dinner and stuff. They make a list of all the changes they want. He'll then come back at 9, do those changes, send it back to them, and then they've got an hour to listen to it again and make a final list of any tweaks. And then he'll come back at like 11 o'clock, do that final list, and then that's it. And there's no... That's the mix done.
That's crazy.
And if they want adjustments beyond that, he's like, well, you know, I charge like $500 an hour or something. And so 9 times out of 10, they'll be like, oh, just leave it.
Yeah.
But you've got to... the more experience you get, I think you start to draw a line and you start applying more rules to things. And because you realise otherwise, like, people will... they'll often think that they're your only customer and that you're just sitting there waiting by the phone for them to tell you what they want changed.
I've definitely had, you know, that kind of attitude towards me because of someone that's, like, running a small studio, still trying to get to that point where I could potentially do it as a full-time job. Yeah. People do think that you're the only person that they're the only person that you're working with.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not the case. I have another job as well. I can't... Yeah. Just because you've paid me, you know, whatever money does not mean that I'm your slave for the next week. And,
no, of course.
And a lot of people I found tend to think like that, and it's not okay, because you wouldn't do that with any other job.
I think the thing is, people view the studio world as being like this big fun thing, and being in recording their tracks as this big fun sort of thing, and they don't think of it as, well, this is your job, or you're trying to make a career out of this. That sort of all goes out of the, you know, if I tell people that I'm a producer or I run a studio, you'll get, and if they're not musicians themselves, they'll be like, when you get a proper job, or they think you just sit around all day like rocking out with guitar amps and drinking coffee and chatting music and stuff all day. And so I think sometimes people just forget that you've got other customers that, you know, I've had it as well from people like, I need to book in next Tuesday because my single's coming out on this date, and they've booked the release date before they've finished recording it. And then I'm like, right, well, I'm booked up for the next like 6 weeks. And then they're like, well, I've got my single release. And you're like, I'm running a business. Like, yeah. I'm not just saying this to be awkward because I can't be bothered to finish your track. That's the way it is. Like, it's a business.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a home life outside of this. I'm not as much as nice as this studio is. I'm not sitting in here on my days off just waiting by the desk or playing around with gear. Like, I might be cleaning my car out or doing my tax return or something.
Yeah, like, a lot of people that run studios also have second jobs as well because, you know, it is a hard business to turn into a full-time job just because there's so much competition, I think, is what it comes down to. Like this, we were saying earlier that in the area that we're in, Kent, there's, you know, dozens of studios all trying to do the same thing. So many musicians and artists, and the biggest studios get people coming down from different areas to record with them, and it's the little ones that suffer because they're all trying to get the same people in.
That's the thing, you have to start out in the local scene, and certainly, like, when I started, I was recording local bands only, because they were the musicians that I knew, and that was my whole sort of bread and butter, was like local musicians. Whereas now it's more people from outside of the area or even people from other countries. I don't record, I still get like a lot of locally based bands in, but that's not the main source of my work now. But yeah, it is, like, there are a lot of studios around. I think the key though is not to think of the studio as the business.
Yeah.
Like, it's to think of like yourself, the business. So if you own a studio, you know, I guess you could dry hire it out to other producers and stuff. Fine, like, that's an option, and you can do rehearsals there and what have you. But if you're the business, then you can take that anywhere. Like, so I've sort of really focused on making it clear to people that, like, my work sounds the way it does because of me, not because of the studio. So they could book someone else to record them at this studio and it wouldn't necessarily sound the same. So people come now to work with me, whereas I think if you're just focusing on, oh well, I've just got to make a name for the studio, then there is a lot of competition. But if you're just building a career for you as a producer, then there isn't so much competition because everybody has their own thing that they can offer to people.
Yeah.
Whereas a studio, you know, there's lots of nice studios around here with decent gear and space
which anyone can hire out,
which anybody can hire out. So, you know, you could either go down the route of creating a really unique studio or something super high end, you know, like Mike's done at Rimshot. Or in addition to that, you can create your own sort of way of working and your own recording style and build a reputation for yourself so that you could go one day and think, oh, I'm going to move down to the West Country now. But it doesn't matter because people travel from all over the country to work with me rather than for that building that I no longer have. So that's a good focal point, I think, is not looking at the studio as the business, but looking at yourself as the business and the studio just being somewhere where you keep your gear and where you generally operate
based
from.
Have you done much stuff in other studios?
I've sort of, like, bands have had me travel around to other studios to do stuff for them, and I've ended up doing stuff on location as well sometimes. Like, if a band wants to record in a obscure, like a barn or something like that, then, you know, I've tracked stuff there. But I'd always tend to mix here because I've got all the gear I need here, and I know the sound of my room and my monitors, and I'm sort of more comfortable here. But I mean, that's like, you know, my goal has been the same for years, which is to do exactly what I was just saying, is just to keep building a reputation for myself as a producer, and then to attract higher profile clients that come because they want to work with me rather than they want to work at my studio. Because the other thing is, you can only charge so much. you know, you can only charge based on what the studio is like and what gear is in it if you're looking at the studio as the business. Whereas if you build a successful career for yourself as an individual and then you start working on records that are selling loads of copies, you can, the sky's the limit in terms of what you can earn as well. And you know, some, like, if someone contacts me and they're like, oh, we want to do our record with you because we've heard this stuff you've done, I could say to them, well, this is what I charge, and they wouldn't be able to go, oh, well, we can get exactly the same or better for half that price from such and such, because that person won't be me. Whereas with the studio, they could go, well, there's other studios with similar gear that are the same size or bigger that actually charge less than you do, so we'll go there. But they can't do that if they're coming, if you've built yourself a reputation, they're not going to get that from anybody else.
And for example, if you haven't got a degree in music technology or something like that, which, you know, I haven't, I dropped out of college a year early to start working on my studio and progress with that because I wasn't doing it whilst I was at college. I had a guy message me, asked me what I charged. I told him, he was like, how can you do that? How can you think of charging that much if you don't even have a degree? And I was like, well, with all due respect, you're paying for what I do, not a certificate that I've earned from, you know, some college. And he was like, oh, fair play. Well, I'm going to go to a studio in London because it's better than your studio and they charge less. I was like, okay, good luck with that. Yeah. I don't want to work with you anyway.
Like, well, the funny thing is, like, I can hand on heart say I don't know one single mix engineer or producer personally that has any qualification in it. I think one person I know might have a BTEC or something, and you know, they didn't even learn anything from doing that anyway. They just happened to have it. But every person that I know that is making a living off of being a mix engineer or producer has never studied it, or they're like me where they, again, I dropped out of college after a year. In fact, I lied my way into Maidstone College because I dropped out of school probably about 9 months before my GCSEs. I hated school. All I wanted to do was play guitar, and I joined this band when I was 15, this like thrash metal band with one of my best friends, and everyone else in the band was like well into their 30s, and we were just in this van kind of gigging every weekend and playing at like biker festivals and, you know, sort of dive bars and stuff. I just wanted to do that. I decided to educate myself at home, but like my mum and dad tried helping me, but I didn't really take that very far. Went back to school to sit my GCSEs, made no effort with them whatsoever. I just wanted to get the exams over and done with. I think I got below C's in everything. The highest grade I got was a C, and that was in music. I then sort of over the summer, so this would be 1998, I'm 36 now.
That was the year I was born.
Oh, was it? So 1998, I just spent the summer again playing in this thrash metal band, and then in September a mate of mine who was a drummer was like, oh, I'm going to Maidstone College. So I was like, oh yeah, I fancy a bit of that, I'll go to college. So went along to the sort of enrollment or audition, whatever it was, and they were like, well, you've got to have 3 GCSEs, grade C or above. And I was just like, oh yeah, I've got those. And they were like, well, you'll have to prove it at some point. I was like, yeah, fine. But part of the audition was you had to play guitar for them. So I played a bit of guitar for them. And they were like, oh, cool, yeah, we'll put you on the course. And they never asked for my GCSEs. Well, I did that for about a year or so. But basically, I wasn't learning anything at all from the course. Like, the studio, like, studios then in colleges were just, like, the worst thing you've ever seen. And we had an old, I think it was a studio master, knackered old, dusty old sort of desk, and a little, might have been a 1-inch tape machine, and a really early version of Cubase. And none of us really learned anything. It was a little bit too informal.
Yeah.
The tutors there were great, but you know, they had limited gear that they could teach us with. And so after about a year, I just thought, fuck this, like, I'm not learning anything. Dropped out, got a sort of crappy job over the summer. And then the following September, so this would be the year 2000 now, another friend of mine was like, oh, I'm going to Canterbury College to do the HND, like music technology. So you needed the GCSEs, which I didn't have, the BTEC, which I didn't have because I dropped out of Maidstone. So again, I just lied to them at the interview. Yeah, I've got the BTEC, I've got the GCSEs. Cool, play a bit of guitar for us. Yeah, do that. Okay, you're on the course. You better prove we've got to see proof you've got the BTEC. Yeah, all right. Like, started the course. And then after about 3 months, I just thought, I'm tired of being educated now.
Yeah.
I'm just going to drop out. So I dropped out of that and then just worked jobs that I hated and put a hardcore band together. And then we got signed and we started touring all over the world, and we were always in and out of studios. And then I started to buy little bits of recording gear and started recording our rehearsals and stuff like that.
Mm.
And, you know, that was when I was probably 19, like 20. And then, it sort of went on from there. But so I'm the perfect example of the dropout.
Yeah.
You know, saying that, like, I was very fortunate because, like I say, the other guitarist in that band, his mum had this big mansion house and she built us a practice room on the side of it. And so I had somewhere that I could put my recording gear.
Mm.
And because we all lived in this house as well, I could go down into that studio at any time and experiment and try mic positions out and read books and watch stuff on YouTube. And, you know, if I emailed a producer and he said, oh, I tend to do this when I'm recording drums, I could go down there and try
it. Do it straight away, yeah.
And she used to let other local bands rehearse in this studio. So I would often say to him, do you mind if I just record your rehearsal so I could practice mixing and stuff? And I would, or me and my friend Adam, the singer in the band I was in, he lived in the house as well, so we'd be like, oh, let's record a Pink Floyd cover, like an acoustic Pink Floyd cover, just for fun. And then we made an album of like Ramones covers and stuff. Mm. And so it was all, I had the opportunity to practice. And then I was doing these rehearsal recordings for bands, and then they would be like, oh, actually we need to do a demo, could you do a demo for us? So then I'd be like, oh, actually this is more like a proper thing. So then I started doing that. Then I started charging people like 10 quid an hour to do demos. And then I was working my day job, and then in the evenings and at weekends I was recording people and charging them for it. And I'd been doing that probably for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
So by the time that studio closed and I found this place, I'd been recording other bands probably for about 4 years and charging them for it. But again, you know, that's not, you know, so I wouldn't encourage people to drop out of, because I was quite fortunate with that situation.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I would say is that that's not the be all and end all. And it means nothing really. Like, it just means that on paper, you know what to do if a snare's too ringy or what have you. Although, you know, saying that, I get people come in here that have done uni or college courses, and some of the stuff they've been taught, you just think that it's just not the way it works. Like, nobody does that, and no active...
Well, I left college for a similar reason. Like, I'd been producing like EDM music and, you know, an FL studio for years.
Oh, yeah.
Since I was like 8. So I'd been doing it for years and years, you know, using EQs, compressors, all that stuff. And, you know, had a decent set of, like, knowledge going into college. I did first 2 years. So I did level two and then level three. So I did the first year of level three. I said to my tutor, I was like, is next year any more advanced? Because I'm not going to lie, I haven't really learnt anything yeah. this year. It's just going over the same things that we did last year for the people that weren't yeah. in this course. He was like, to be honest, no, it's pretty much the same thing. Just we kind of learn a little bit more. And I was like, well, can you kind of basically yeah. run me through what we're going to be going through? So he did. I was like, I don't think that's going to be beneficial for yeah. me to be here for that. And he was like, to be honest, I agree with you. You know, I don't think it'd be beneficial for you either. He was like, well, what are you thinking of doing? So I told him plans to set up a studio. He was like, yeah, go for it. So my tutor was encouraging me to leave yeah. college and do it, because the thing is,
I think they've got a sort of curriculum that they have to adhere to. Yeah. And they're like, you know, these people are going to be here for 2 years or 3 years. We've got to fill it up with yeah. something. So you end up getting taught stuff that you are never going to need to know. Mm. And I do definitely think that if you've got the opportunity to do so, the best thing to do is just to dive in head first yeah. and just start doing it. You know, even if you're if you're working full time and you haven't got a studio premises, you know, you can get put a mobile set up together and offer to record bands in locations, yeah. go to rehearsals and record bands and then mix stuff at home. And then once there's a bit of a portfolio, then you can start charging people to do it. And then as you get busier, eventually you'll get to a point where you'll go, I've got to make the transition yeah. now. I'm going to make it a full time thing.
Yeah.
That's the best way to do it. Just get out there, start networking, yeah. And go from there.
Yeah, definitely. I think if I hadn't have dropped out, I would have been known. I've been doing it for about 2 years now, so I'd be a year yeah. back where I was with
nothing. That's the thing. You would be, and then you'd be sort of 2 years behind.
Yeah.
Because you'd come out of that course and just do what you're doing now anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
But you'd be 2 years older.
Yeah.
You know, it's a good age. You know, that's pretty much the age that I started doing it.
Yeah.
But I get constantly emails from people that are looking for studio jobs, and that I can do this, and, you know, I can edit that, and I've got this qualification and that qualification, and they're fresh out of college or uni, and I'm thinking, I'm literally not interested in any of that stuff. Like, if I'm going to employ somebody, I want somebody that knows what it's like to run a session.
Mm.
I want somebody that has experienced that sort of studio burn
yeah.
where you're tired and your eyes are watering and you can't hear properly, and that is used to dealing with people. And, you know, the technical side of things, they don't need to know, because I can do that yeah. anyway. You know, I want someone that understands what it's like to actually run a session,
yeah.
not someone that's got a uni degree that's just like, oh yeah, yeah, tell me about it. Recording sessions late nights, and you think you've literally no idea, like, until you've done it and you've sat up till like 3 or 4 in the morning and you've had a tiny little room with loads of musicians and they're all screaming and shouting while you're trying to mix and stuff. Like, that's more important to me as a prospective employer.
Mm.
Like I say, you're better off just getting out there and doing it. Yeah.
People were paying me to record them when I was at college. I was using the college studios at the end of the day to record bands that were also at the college, because yeah. there was the live course and the
Canterbury
live,
College.
Yeah, so yeah. like the live performance course and the production course, which is what I was doing.
Mm.
Maybe 3 or 4 bands towards the end of me being there. That
so I wonder, was Eric there?
Yeah.
When, yeah, so that's who used to live in that building.
Oh.
Eric White. He's cool, Eric. He's a really nice guy.
Guy with the dreadlocks.
Yeah, yeah. That's him.
Yeah. Yeah, he was my tutor.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah, he's awesome.
He's left now, unfortunately.
He has, yeah.
Do you know any of the other tutors there at all?
A friend of mine, Scott, used to work
Scott
there.
Scott
Byatt.
He was one of my tutors as well.
He's an amazing drummer. Yeah. He's like literally one of the best drummers
he's
ever.
Crazy.
But yeah, I've known him for years. But yeah, he's no longer there. Eric's no longer there. No. But yeah, Eric lived in that building where me and Chess live now. until about 18 months ago. And he'd lived there for a couple of years before I took this studio over. So he's always been there. Like, he was in there and I was in here. And he had, in what is now our bedroom, was his little studio. Setup. Like, he had a little like,
he
dance.
Makes, like, Gabba? Is it Gabba, the genre? It's, like, really...
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of, like, dancing.
Yeah,
sort
he's,
of stuff.
He's actually, you know, quite well known for it, I think.
Yeah, Eric Orpheus, I think, is his one. DJ name.
Yeah.
But, yeah, but he also... works for my landlord Dave, like doing live sound and okay. stuff as well. But yeah, I know a guy called Andy is now the Andy Sharps is now the sort of head of that course, I think. And again, like, I've recorded him quite a few times. But I think he might have taken over from Eric or Scott, I'm not quite sure, but I know, yeah, they're not there anymore. Mm. But I did go to that college in November. I had to do a little talk about sort of production, like a little workshop thing.
Oz actually did one when I was at college.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, which I actually kind of want to ask him to go on the podcast because he was, again, another person that influenced me to just go for it.
Right.
So I think that'd be quite cool if I could.
Yeah.
I've got him on Facebook, give him a message.
He actually did that course, I think, Oz, back in the day.
Yeah, because he's friends with Scott, I think. Which is how Scott got him to come in and talk, I think.
Oh,
or he knows
right.
of Scott. They know each other, at least.
I think when Oz did... I mean, certainly, like, when I did the course at Canterbury, it was when the old... Like, the Canterbury College, the building that's there now, wasn't there. It was a completely different building, which has all been knocked down.
Okay.
And the music department was in a different building and it was a completely different studio. Mm. Whereas when I went there in November, it was like, if you came into the college, it was to the left of the main college building.
Yeah,
there was like a music
block.
A
separate
and there's
block.
Two studios. And one of them had, I think it was a Toft console in there. And one might have had like a Mackie
yeah.
or a Mackie 8 bus or something
yeah,
in
was,
there.
Yeah.
But the one I thought the one with the Toft console in it was actually quite a nice control room.
But the live room for the other studio I thought was better. In my
opinion. But the other one with the Mackie in, well, there was all sorts of problems with the gear, and you know it's difficult in a college because the gear is getting
look
used
after the gear.
And abused, and so you know headphones like weren't working properly, or they could only send one headphone mix out, and it was in mono and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's good. Like, those courses are good for meeting other musicians and like
definitely.
Networking
I mean,
and stuff.
You know,
and
so many of my friends and people that I've actually recorded now, I met through college.
Mm.
I sometimes wonder how different my life would be now if I hadn't have done it. So I'm glad that I did. I don't regret
doing
it at all. It's just it wasn't for me. But yeah, I wouldn't ever deter someone from doing it.
Yeah.
Because it's the life experience as well. And,
oh, totally, yeah.
And you do learn things. It's not like I didn't learn anything, because I did, but I just wasn't learning enough.
I think. It's, you know, I think if you sort of think, well, all I need to do is go to college and then I'll be sorted, like, that's when it's not good. But I think if you sort of use that as a basis and then, you know, form your own sort of, teach yourself stuff alongside it, then it can be beneficial. And you know, if you don't have a studio, then you've at least got the college studios where you can sort of put your ideas into practice.
And that's,
as
you know,
well,
that's how I started out using the college studios. I'd be there hours after the college is shut, and they'd kick me out eventually because I'd be sitting in the studio like all the time.
Oh, it's cool they'd let you use that.
Yeah, see, that was like the one really good thing that I loved about college, is that I had a space to progress in and work from, because this was before I had my studio, and it was a bit kind of dodgy that if I wanted to start charging, I couldn't really do it in the college studio and all this stuff. So I just bit the bullet and left, really, but definitely glad I did it.
That's the thing, at least you're a couple of years in now, and you know, again, as time goes on, you gradually accumulate more gear, word spreads, you know, if you've got somewhere that you can operate from where you haven't got like massive overheads, and you've got a job that can fund it, you know, it should be
that's
a success.
Kind of the best situation you can be in, isn't
it? Ideal, really.
Oh, well, man, I think.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Does that probably sort of cover everything?
Cool. So that's that. First episode done. I want to say a massive thank you to Dan Lucas again for allowing me to talk with him for a while. And if you've made it this far, thank you so much for listening. Please let me know how this has been, if it's good or shit. I guess we'll find out. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.